Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 19th of May. The Dalai Lama was in Madison over this weekend to celebrate the public opening of the University of Wisconsin-Madison Center for Investigating Healthy Minds. New studies and elaborate studies at the University of Wisconsin are using neuroscience, brain imaging, to study such qualities as kindness and compassion and the effects of contemplative practices, including meditation, on the brain. Joining us this hour is Dr. Richard Davidson, William James and Vilas Research Professor of Psychology and Psychiatry at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and Director of the Laboratory for Functional Brain Imaging and Behavior. Your director of this Center for Investigating Healthy Minds. He said that he first met the Dalai Lama in 1992, and he credits him with inspiring the idea of this center. I'm sure you'll have calls this hour. We'll be welcoming them, as we always do, at 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And our email address, as always, is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Dr. Richard Davidson, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we saw this picture of the Dalai Lama that was in the Journal Sentinel, and it is such a beautiful picture. I feel like cutting it out and putting it on my computer so I can be happy, because he looks so happy and peaceful and twinkling, and it's just a great picture.
Well, he is that way much of the time.
Yeah. So tell me about your meeting with him in 1992, because it inspired all that has happened now with this new center.
Well, I had the opportunity to meet him face-to-face for the first time in 1992, and it was at that meeting that he challenged me to consider the possibility of applying the rigorous tools that neuroscience had so well developed and applied to the study of anxiety and fear and depression and things of that sort to the study of positive qualities of the mind, to characteristics like happiness, like compassion, like kindness. And it became clear to me early on in this dialogue with the Dalai Lama that health is not simply the absence of illness. And so we can't define health simply by the absence of fear or anxiety or depression, but it really is something more. And the other important nugget in all of this is that qualities like kindness and happiness and compassion are best regarded as the product of skills that can be enhanced through training. And this is something that is central to his message, and something that modern neuroscientific research is actually bearing out.
And what kinds of skills are you talking about, Dr. Davidson? What do you train people to be able to do?
Well, we can train them to be more compassionate, we believe, which affects their brain and their behavior, to have a greater propensity to want to help others in the face of suffering, to act in ways which are more altruistic. I think it's also possible to train people to be happier. And so this work is still very much in its infancy, but the early findings certainly indicate that training even among individuals who are novices who have only practiced for a short period of time, even as short as 2 weeks for 30 minutes a day, do show changes in the brain and behavior, which are products of the training. And so this is I think, a hopeful message, but it really shouldn't be surprising to anyone, because it really isn't. It's not fundamentally different from something like physical exercise. And anyone who's practiced physical exercise knows that if they practice for 30 minutes a day for 2 weeks, they would notice changes. And so mental exercise is really something very much akin to physical exercise.
And considering what the outcomes may be, I think you should sign up the whole world. What do you think?
I think it would certainly make the world a better place from everything we know. I do believe that as the science in this area develops, it will affect public opinion and public policy in ways, again, that are very similar to physical health. 50 years ago, a much smaller fraction of the culture regularly practiced physical exercise. But as the scientific research began to show very forcefully and consistently that physical exercise is something that's good for our health, many more people began to engage in it, and I think the same thing will happen for mental exercise.
And by mental exercise, are you talking about what the Dalai Lama practices, a form of meditation?
I am talking about forms of meditation, although these forms of meditation, I believe, can be made completely secular. They are universal kinds of methods. They can be practiced, I believe, by individuals of any religious conviction or, for that matter, by those with no religious conviction. And so that they are forms of meditation, but they're not forms of religious meditation. They are forms of secular meditation.
Mm-hmm. And tell me what you do every day in that regard.
I practice meditation daily. I've been practicing for more than 30 years.
Oh, my goodness.
I find that it's something enormously helpful to my everyday life.
Do you do this when you wake up? Or?
Yes, I do it early in the morning.
And it's helpful in what regard? It makes your brain sharper? Are you happier?
I think I am happier. I feel I'm more emotionally balanced, not to say that that I'm anywhere near completely balanced, but, I think that I live what would be objectively classified, I think, as a very stressful life. I have many balls in the air. I travel a lot. I have huge numbers of commitments. I work very long hours, but I don't find that it really wears me down. I haven't missed a day of work because of illness in probably more than a decade.
Oh, my.
I think that it just gives me a lot of energy, and I'm not drained by the challenges of my work life, but rather I can be nourished by them.
I know that you've done, and I find this so fascinating, a great deal of study and brain imaging of some monks, people who are associates of the Dalai Lama, I believe, and probably others. And we hear these remarkable stories about what some are able to accomplish as a result of meditation. What have you learned from studying those brains? And tell me more about those brains that you studied.
We have been engaged as one of our projects. This is a long-term project that's still ongoing in the study of long-term meditation practitioners. These are individuals who have devoted a remarkably significant portion of their adult life to these practices, and you can think of these people as experts. All of them have practiced a minimum of 10,000 hours, and the 10,000-hour number was not something that we just pulled out of a hat. Rather, 10,000 hours is a number that actually has been identified in research on expertise across many different complex domains. So we know, for example, that in order to be a reasonably accomplished musician, one needs to practice a minimum of 10,000 hours. To be a competitive athlete, again, 10,000 hours. To be a competitive chess player, same thing. virtually any complex domain requires a minimum of 10,000 hours to demonstrate sort of basic entry-level expertise. And so that's what we used as a criterion in our study, and the average number of lifetime hours of practice among our long-term practitioners is approximately 34,000 hours. What we hope by studying these individuals is that we would get a good picture of the further reaches of neuroplasticity that is produced through mental training. This work has been extremely helpful to us in understanding what the changes that can be produced are, and we have noticed a number of different features of brain activity that change as a function of practice, including neural circuits that are very important for the regulation of attention, and also circuits that are very important for the regulation of emotion. This gives us a better idea of what to look for in less accomplished practitioners, it gives us some signposts, if you will. We can then use that in studies that we're now conducting where we are examining longitudinal changes in individuals who are much less well-practiced, but looking at changes in the brain as they go through some course of practice, whether it's 2 weeks or 2 months, determine whether the less practiced individuals show changes in the same brain circuits that were altered in the long-term practitioners. And by and large, the answer to that question, with some complications, but for the most part, is showing that the novice practitioners do show changes in many of the same circuits, although the changes typically are not nearly as dramatic as what we've seen in the long-term practitioners.
Yes. Have you done studies already, or are you about to do studies on breathing, on school children, veterans suffering from post-traumatic stress, prison inmates transitioning back into society?
Those were all areas that were named as part of the opening of our center, and they're areas that we are focusing on in the translational research efforts of our center. That is, efforts to take the findings that we've obtained in the laboratory and apply them in more real-world contexts with people who are suffering and where we potentially could make a real difference. The education work is probably furthest along, and we're starting up a large project that will begin this coming fall in the Madison Public School System with fifth grade teachers and students. We've been planning that project for more than a year now. It's a very complex project. It involves, as I said, both teachers and students, required a lot of coordination and interaction with personnel in the school district that we've been engaged with over this past year. The project with returning veterans is something that is obviously very, very timely, and many people have seen news reports of individuals coming back from war zones, from Iraq and Afghanistan, who have very difficult time adjusting back into their communities. And we've begun some work on a pilot basis with these individuals, and the initial pilot findings have encouraged us to go on to look at this more systematically, and that is something that will be occurring also over the course of this next year. And the third area is working with prisoners as they, in the period just prior to their release and as they release back into their community. And this is a project that we are extremely interested in, and we've begun interactions with the Department of Corrections. I've met with the Secretary of the Department of Corrections in the state of Wisconsin, as well as the governor, and there is a good deal of interest in us examining that, and we hope to start that at some point in the next year. That's the least furthest along, but we have begun to lay the groundwork for that.
We welcome phone calls for Dr. Richard Davidson in just one moment. We've had him on before, but our interest in today's program prompted by the opening last weekend, the public opening of the University of Wisconsin-Madison Center for Investigating Healthy Minds. The Dalai Lama was there to celebrate the opening, and our guest credits the Dalai Lama for his profound interest in this topic and for inspiring the idea for a center. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you would like to join us by email, that would be fine. That's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest next hour will be presenting one of the symposiums at the LZ Lambeau event, which is coming up this weekend in Green Bay. They're doing a symposium on music, and they are in the process of writing a book on how music was, as those of you who lived through the era know, an integral part of the 1960s. But the music that people who listened to as they were serving in Vietnam had a different meaning. The same song may have a profoundly different meaning for those serving than it did for people who were stateside. So we'll have two guests with us writing a book on this, and we'll listen to some of the music of the era as well. That's the second hour of our show. To your phone calls, our lines are busy right now, but keep trying and you'll be able to get through. 800-486-8655. Lisa is our first caller. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm very excited to hear about this center, and I guess my question is this. As a wellness, health promotion wellness practitioner within the Wisconsin area for business and industry, it sounds like this might have a lot of similar correlation to areas of positive psychology. And I guess my question is there a possible certification or a program for people who are in business and industry right now trying to do whole person models and really integrating the power of positive psychology and, you know, sharing the studies and information with business and industry to kind of adopt that model and create those types of cultures within the workplace to be a little bit more accepting? If there is, where could I go for more information on results of your pilot study in the school districts? Is there internship possibilities? I think this is fabulous.
Well, thank you so much for your comments and question. We do not have a certification program. Our center is largely a research center, but we will, as part of outreach efforts that we will engage in on a regular basis, we will have what we'll call something like a day with the experts, where the latest findings will be showcased and new information will be presented, and we are committed to doing that on a regular basis and making it available gratis to the community. Also, you can go on to our website, www.investigatinghealthyminds.org, and there is a wealth of information available on the website about the current research that we are engaged in and similar work going on elsewhere in other laboratories throughout the country and the world. The website, we hope, will become a major repository for information in this area.
Is this a unique place, too?
I would say it is unique. I don't think there's any place quite like it elsewhere in the world. because we have, just in terms of the physical resources alone, we have meditation space that we'll use for research purposes that is physically adjacent to one of the world's most well-equipped and sophisticated brain imaging laboratories. And the combination of this is truly unique and reflects commitment we have to the area of what we call contemplative neuroscience, which we're helping to establish and nurture. And so I very much think that this is the epicenter of work of this kind in the world right now. But our hope is that it won't be, because our hope is that we can help spread interest and nurture other nascent efforts at other institutions in this country and throughout the world.
Yes. Thanks, Lisa. Megan from Green Bay. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, if your speaker was going to be going around the state at all to any of the UW system schools and talking about the center and what the hours are for the public.
Well, I don't currently have plans to do that, but thank you for the suggestion. I have appeared in various places throughout the state over the last few years and would certainly be happy to entertain other possibilities. So keep that in mind, and you can check out our website for places where I or other members of our scientific staff will be giving talks.
Thanks, Megan. And she asked, does the center have a public aspect? Can you walk through your doors and take a look or volunteer to be a subject?
Well, certainly there are research efforts underway where participants can volunteer to participate in research efforts, some of which involve the teaching of different types of meditation. These are publicized on our website, and any interested listener who wishes to participate can learn more about our efforts on our website. And again, it's okay. www.investigatinghealthyminds.org.
All right. Thanks, Megan, for your call. Melanie in Lake Geneva, hi.
Hi. I was wondering if the doctor could recommend a book for those of us who would like to learn to meditate. I'll hang up and listen to the answer.
All right.
Thank you for the question. There are many books, I think, which provide a very useful introduction. Among the authors that I would recommend are John Kabat-Zinn, K-A-B-A-T-Z-I-N-N. He was one of the participants in our weekend opening events. He is a professor emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center in Worcester, Massachusetts, and he is the developer of mindfulness-based stress reduction, which is a very popular 8-week course in meditation that is taught at academic medical centers throughout the world. He's the author of a number of popular books. One of them is called Full Catastrophe Living. Another is called Wherever You Go, There You Are. And he also has CDs available that provide guided meditation. So that would certainly be one good place to start. And if you're in the Madison area, there's a group at the university in the Integrative Medicine Division who teaches mindfulness-based stress reduction, and I would recommend that you contact them.
And what about your book? Have you written the history of all of this? It would be fascinating, Dr. Davidson.
Well, thank you for the nudge. And,
just
actually,
what you need.
I'm under contract right now to write my first popular book. So the book will be written over the next year, and I look forward to its completion. So I'm actively working on it.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. Are you enjoying it?
Yes, I am.
Good. Thank you, Linda, for your call. Brian in the Wisconsin Dells. Hi.
Good morning. My question is with the work towards this, are they planning on integrating this to treatment centers for recovering addicts?
It's a very good question, and there is research going on the application of meditation-based interventions for the treatment of addiction. And in many ways, these methods, I think, are ideally suited to address addiction problems because they actively deal with craving. Craving is one of the elements, one of the key elements that produces suffering, and some of these meditation practices are designed to directly address and serve as an antidote to craving. I think there is a lot of potential, and there are a number of scientists throughout the country who are engaged in research specifically focused on the application of these methods to addiction. I don't know of any programs per se in the local area where this is being done. There is a physician here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison by the name of James Davis who is particularly interested in the application of these techniques to addiction, and certainly he's someone that might be contacted about this.
Mm-hmm. Are we talking about something that's fairly easy to learn, that we can all pick up, Dr. Davidson, that you can learn in a short period of time, maybe not become a master, but you can, how do you learn it?
It can be learned, I think, quite easily, but it's one of these things that is utterly simple, but quite difficult at the same time. It can be learned, I think, quite easily, but it takes a significant amount of practice to really embody it. You know, it's like learning a golf swing. The elements of it are pretty simple. I don't play golf, but just from talking to people who do, or any other kind of sport. Learning to row, the elements of a stroke are pretty straightforward, but actually executing it with skill and efficiency takes a lot of practice. And it's the same thing with meditation. Simple forms of meditation may involve, for example, just paying attention to your breathing, not changing your breathing, but just paying attention to the breathing. And it sounds utterly simple, but some of the things that are the most simple are also extraordinarily difficult. And so it takes practice.
Thank you, Brian. Linda in Germantown. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I'm very much a novice at meditation. I just started a few weeks ago. I don't have an overly stressful life, but job and being a single woman out, being responsible for myself and a grandmother of three does keep me quite active, and sometimes it can be a little stressful. But I went to the library and picked up every book I could about meditation, and it kind of steered me off into the Buddhist religion, and I read several books from the Dalai Lama, and I can't believe how much just teaching myself simple meditation, how much it has changed my life. And in that respect, the way that I communicate to people, the calmness that I have now in my job, with my family, it has just totally turned everything around. And I just wanted to know, you have met the Dalai Lama and had, I'm sure, many conversations with him. Is he honestly such a jovial, happy person, and does he, like, have a connection with everyone that he meets?
Well, thank you for the comments, and I'm so pleased to hear that you're finding such benefit from these methods. And the answer to your question is yes. He is an extraordinary inspiration to be around because he is so extraordinarily kind and compassionate and happy and makes you feel so utterly relaxed and awake in his presence. It has been one of the joys of my life, one of the most significant joys of my life, to have this ongoing relationship with him and to be able to see him several times a year and spend time with him. Just being in his presence is, to me, so inspiring and a testament to what we can do to train our mind to be more like that. And he is, at the same time, he's utterly human. And very humble. So I think that it's a wonderful example. I think those listeners who've had the opportunity to see him in person have some sense of this. It is just wonderful that he is available to humanity in this way.
Mm. Thank you very much, Linda, for the call. Tell me what the role is, because it seems to me as though human suffering, environmental degradation, which we're dealing with a huge oil spill right now, wars that continue, people who are senselessly killed, violence, etc. What is the role of outrage and taking action against all that is really harmful in this world and a pursuit of happiness? How do you put those together?
Well, I think the key is harnessing the energy that arises from a kind of moral indignation at the transgressions which are occurring and the suffering that that is being produced. I think that if one is able to act from a stance of equanimity and compassion toward others, I think it helps in channeling this kind of energy rather than just flailing in a kind of unconstrained way, which often occurs in response to the kind of suffering which is so unfortunately prevalent on the planet right now. Part of it is really about skillful means and harnessing the energy that is unleashed when this kind of suffering is encountered and when we experience a kind of moral indignation of the sort that you're describing.
We go to Earl next from Medford. Hi, Earl.
Good morning. Great topic. On the athletic front, I must have spent 10,000 hours, but I never learned how to hit a curveball in baseball. So it's still frustrating.
Keep trying, Earl.
More seriously, I wanted to follow up on what Kathleen said. The Dalai Lama is dealing with so much, and the Tibetan people being invaded and occupied by China, the Dalai Lama being viewed kind of as a criminal. Do his techniques really help with these major, major things that he and the Tibetan people are going through?
Well, I think they do. I think that if you look at his demeanor and if you look at how the Tibetan people are coping with the tragedy that's been inflicted on them, I think that by and large, these kinds of methods and the cultural traditions in which they are embedded are helping produce a more balanced kind of response. It's not a controlled experiment, and we don't have a complete set of observations that we might like, but my own conjecture is that it does help. And You know, I think that the Dalai Lama has managed to have a kind of moral voice in this world, largely because of his commitment to nonviolence and his compassionate approach to what is really a tragic problem.
Thank you.
Thank you, Earl, so much for your call, and good luck on that curveball. Yeah, we go next to Kay in East Troy. Hi, Kay.
Good morning. It's a privilege to speak with you. My question is, what do you think about running as a form of meditation?
Running?
Yes.
Well, I think that one can engage in certain kinds of sports with a contemplative presence. I think that really the goal of formal meditation practice when you're sitting on a cushion or sitting in a chair and meditating is to infuse those qualities with everyday life. If the benefits that were derived from meditation only occurred while you were actually meditating, then it would kind of be useless. And so to the extent that one can could take these qualities and infuse them with other activities in which we're engaged in our daily life, which would include physical exercise like running, I think that's great. I think, though, that having periods where one is exclusively focused on meditating are also helpful as a complement to bringing these qualities into other activities in our daily life. So I think that one can run in a kind of meditative way, but I think it's probably not a substitute for doing formal meditation either.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you.
Thanks, Kay. More phone calls in just one moment. Our guest this hour is Dr. Richard Davidson, William James and Vilas Research Professor of Psychology and Psychiatry at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, Director of the Laboratory for Functional Brain Imaging and Behavior, and Director of the Just Open to the Public Center for Investigating Healthy Minds. That opening took place last weekend. The Dalai Lama was in attendance, and Davidson credits the Dalai Lama. He met him first in 1992 with inspiring the idea for the center. More phone calls momentarily. For the first time, we have a couple lines open. 800-486-8655 is our number. We also have this email, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, the story of the Vietnam War through the music-based memories of those who served. Doug Bradley will be with us, served in Long Binh, Vietnam, in the early 70s as an information specialist, and Craig Warner, a music historian and chair of the Afro-American Studies Department at UW-Madison. These two gentlemen are writing a book right now on music and the Vietnam veteran. So that's our number two of our program this Wednesday. Our next caller is Bea. Hi, Bea.
Hi, Kathleen. Your program is one of the best on the Wisconsin State Station. Thank you much.
Thank you, Bea.
I just wanted to share this. In the 60s, I was teaching in Milwaukee, and a woman came up from Chicago and taught yoga at the Y. There were 100 women in that gym, and we entered in silence. You could hear a pin drop. In the 70s, I taught abroad and learned TM, Transcendental Meditation. In the late 80s, I learned Zen meditation from Joko Beck in San Diego. Meditation has been such an integral part of my life, and I think I would be a different person had I not been meditating in these various forms over the years. I've tried to teach this to my students on the side. I don't think many of them adopted meditation, but perhaps in the future they'll come across someone who will engender the desire in them. I just want to share that. Thank you much.
Thank you, B. Dr.
Thank
Davidson.
You.
You know, it seems as though it's, I'm wondering, there are a lot of people who are interested in meditation, but we also live, as you say, you've got a schedule that's unbelievable. You're traveling, you're teaching at this center that just opened. People are raising children and working full-time and caring for their aging parents and sometimes sick parents, and our lives are just pretty jammed these days. Is it something that people feel, I don't have the time to do this? Is it, I know there are some people who are extremely interested in learning how to do this, but I'm wondering if our society and the pace of our society keeps many of us from thinking we even have the time for it.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. The pace does lead people to conclude that they often don't have the time for it, I think it really is a challenge. And my advice to someone who is just starting out, who feels that it's just impossible for them to fit anything more into their already overcrowded lives, is to just begin extremely modestly, even if they practice for 5 minutes a day. Try it for 5 minutes a day and kind of make a commitment to do 5 minutes a day for a week. Then see how it is, and you can build up gradually. And I don't think that anybody can honestly say that they can't afford 5 minutes a day. And I think that many people can shave off 5 minutes by doing things a little bit more efficiently. And although we don't have the scientific evidence in at this point as to whether 5 minutes can make a difference, my conjecture is that it is a not unreasonable way to start. And I think a person can begin to taste the benefit of it, and then they may gradually on their own increase the amount of time that they do it.
Camille in Frankfort, Michigan. Hi.
Hi, thank you. It's so wonderful to hear about the center that you've opened.
Thank you.
A teacher that I had about 20 years ago, a teacher of meditation and consciousness studies, spoke about the pineal gland and how little was known about it, and that he suspected that in time people would learn much more about the function of it and the and its relevance to consciousness. So what I might ask you is, do you know about the function of the pineal gland and things that affect it?
Well, the pineal gland figured prominently in some early theories of consciousness as early as Descartes. He nominated the pineal gland as an important site through which mind-body interaction occurs. Those views have been largely discredited in the face of modern research. The pineal gland does do some important things, including transduce the influence of light on the brain, and plays a very important role in circadian regulation of rhythms that vary with the light and dark cycle of our day. But I think that most neuroscientists today would adopt the view that consciousness is sufficiently complex that it is not associated with any one specific place in the brain, but rather is a distributed property of the brain and arises from complex interactions among many different components of the brain. So while the pineal gland is important for certain functions, it's certainly, based on modern research, not going to be the key to understanding consciousness.
Thank you, Camille, for your call. Sue in Hayward. Hi, Sue.
Hi. Yes, I just had a comment. I have been a longtime meditator, over 20 years, and have experienced wonderful, wonderful results. I know I wouldn't be who I am without it. And I just wanted to, Doctor, earlier you mentioned how simple the practice is, and it is profoundly that. Meditation is as easy as breathing. But I don't see that it really is difficult. The difficulty, I mean, on any level, is just to practice. It's just being true to your practice, to sitting, to be making a commitment to sit, whether that be 5 minutes, like you said, or hopefully longer, and then to see the benefits from that. Father Thomas Keating, who teaches centering prayer, which is simply a Christian form of meditation, talks about there's no way to do it wrong. It's really just having that intention when you sit on your cushion, on your chair. So I just encourage people, anyone can do it. It's literally as easy as breathing. It's just a matter of making the commitment to go to that chair for beginning with 5 minutes to 10 minutes to hopefully working up to 20 minutes twice a day, ideally, or longer.
And what are the results for you, Sue?
Absolutely a different way of seeing the world. There's just more space. There really is more compassion. If I certainly towards people that I see are suffering, or even if I'm getting angry with my husband, my kids, at my job, there's a pause. There's a space where I can see before I react. It's just there's a little more room in my life rather than being run by my emotions.
Mm, that's quite a description. I like that. Dr. Davidson.
Yes, well, thank you. I think you have stated it extremely eloquently, and I agree with you that, you know, from the kind of perspective you're describing, it is extraordinarily easy. There's really nothing to do. There's just allowing the mind to rest in its natural state. From that perspective, I completely agree, and I think the way you describe the benefits of meditation for yourself really fit very beautifully within both the classical descriptions and also what we're learning from hard-nosed scientific research. So I thank you for your comments.
Thanks so much for the call. Because you've known him so long and see him so many times, and he's such a fascinating person to many of us, can you tell me a little more about the Dalai Lama? Does he talk a lot? Do you tell jokes? Does he laugh? How do you spend time with him?
all of the above. He does talk a lot. He laughs an enormous amount. His laughs are very full and very hearty. He is someone who has a tremendous dynamic range of emotion. He can go from being very stern to just cracking up hysterically in a matter of seconds, which most people don't do. He is deeply curious. He's, extraordinarily smart. He is just amazingly kind. He pays attention to everyone. He does not make a distinction between someone with a title, someone with wealth, and someone who's a beggar. Everyone is equally important to him, and I really believe that. Mm. And that is, and you see it in how he behaves. Mm. And that is something that I think is just remarkable, and you can't help but be affected in his presence when you see
I'm
that.
I'm sure. Not many people are that way. I'm sure that's something. One more phone call. Mary from Milwaukee. Hi.
Good morning. This is a very, very fascinating program. I worked for many years. I'm retired currently. I worked for many years in a public school system and was very interested in moral reasoning, teaching moral reasoning to students. And there's a program called Second Step, teaching empathy, anger control, and impulse management. And I was just wondering, this fifth grade program, does that have any kind of a basis in teaching kids problem solving, like I said, moral reasoning questions?
It's a good question, and it's not fundamentally rooted in that, although it is certainly my expectation that it would affect that. You know, I think that these programs in moral reasoning are very, very interesting, but I think one of the things that has not been a feature of those programs is systematic practice. And everything in neuroscience is teaching us that in order to change behavior, in order to change habits, you need systematic practice. Just exposing kids to moral dilemmas and having them sort of reason their way through it, while it's useful, it's not in and of itself, I think, going to be enough to really change behavior.
Thank you, Mary, so much for the call. Dr. Davidson, a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you for the hour.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
InvestigatingHealthyMinds.org is all one thing. You know, InvestigatingHealthyMinds.org is the website. You'll get a lot more information about this new Center for Investigating Healthy Minds, and we'll also post that on our Facebook page at the Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour and to Rhonda Fanning for on air. Actually, Rhonda did the production work and also did on air. Thanks very much, Rhonda. And thanks for listening, everybody, and all of your calls. Interesting hour coming up.